Fancy a game?
Tyler Bischoff is...
And are they both trying not to laugh at the word duty?
Yeah.
Technically correct.
Why is she speaking
like... Because they learned English from Professor Magoo over there.
Relax, we'll be in and out. Anyway, you've never seen my lab.
Oh, great. I get to see your nerd lab.
Hello, Xavier Jones. But we will start with UNLV football because Kenyon Oblat is going to start at quarterback again on Saturday against Vanderbilt. Armani Rogers is not healthy. Tony Sanchez said if the game was on Monday, yesterday, that Armani would not have been able to play, and they do not think he will be better by Saturday. Armani Rogers has a knee injury. He is cleared to play, but the way Tony Sanchez described it yesterday is kind of what we've been talking about. He's not really able to run very well. He wouldn't be able to scramble if they called a pass play and there was nothing there. He wouldn't really be able to pull on his own read and take off on his own very well. So it's not an issue of him not being cleared to play. It's an issue of his biggest strength is pretty much taken away from him because of that knee injury, so they're not going to use him. The possible concern, I think, is it's on Monday, they're saying Kenyon Oblad's going to start and pretty much ruling out Armani Rogers. He could still play, but pretty much ruling out Armani Rogers. That's like a week, and they're saying, yeah, he's not going to be ready to play by then. So that makes it seem like this Armani Rogers injury could keep lingering on, is a little bit more serious than just a small knee injury. But going with Kenyon Oblad is the right call if Armani Rogers doesn't have 100% health in his knee. What's funny is it should actually be a better opportunity for Oblad to play well against Vanderbilt than it was against Boise State, because Vanderbilt has not been very good this year. Even though they're in the SEC, they probably have a worse defense than Boise State. They probably have a worse defense than Wyoming, too. So this is probably the easiest team that Kenyon Oblad will have played so far. But with the quarterback spot, if we look back into the past, Armani Rogers has missed time in all 3 years that he has been the starting quarterback. And the only time that they have had success was when Johnny Stanton took over in the 2017 season. And when Johnny Stanton took over, the offense changed to a point where they tried to basically be more of a ball control offense. They stuck to the run game more than ever. Now, granted, Johnny Stanton runs better than Kenyon Oblad does, so you can still run some of the same zone read. But the main difference was they changed a big chunk of the passing game to be short passes. They went more and more to the short passing game with Johnny Stanton than they did with Armani Rogers or Max Gillum last year, or even Kenyon Oblad so far this season. Their plan was to just run safe, high-percentage plays and keep their defense on the sideline. And to an extent, it worked. I mean, they went 2-1 with Johnny Stanton at quarterback. They went to Fresno State and won. Now, that's one of the wins they have in the Sanchez era that you're like, how the hell did they do that? And they only ran 71 plays per game. Last year with Max Gillum, they ran 75 plays per game. It's not a huge difference, but it is an uptick, and they went 1-5. This year, they're 0-1 with Oblad as the starter, and they ran 86 plays against Boise State. So that's the only time they've had success, is when Johnny Stanton was in there and when they were like, all right, we're not going to go extremely fast. We're going to run it more. When Johnny Stanton was the quarterback for those three games, they only threw it more than they ran it one time, and they threw it 34 times against BYU and ran it 33 times. So it was still almost rushing more. We just had a game where Kenyon Oblad threw it 55 times in a game. So if you're going to win with a quarterback not named Armani Rogers, A, you can't have your quarterback throwing 55 times, but B, you've got to go to a much more conservative thinking on offense. There's no need to go fast. There's no need to try to throw the ball a lot or even down the field that often. You just have to be more conservative. You want to try to kill that game off as much time as you can. Kill as many possessions out of that game as you can. Only give Vanderbilt, you know, 7 possessions to score over 4 quarters. And give yourself 7 or 8 possessions to score over 4 quarters. That's probably your best chance to win. At least since Armani Rogers has been hurt, that's the only way they've really done it. That's the only way that's what they did against San Diego State last year too, when they won with Max Gillum. They ran the ball extremely well and they killed that. Now, San Diego State also kills games off, so they kind of help with that. But that's how they've won without Armani Rogers, is basically trying to kill games off. And I think that sort of highlights what's been the biggest problem with the quarterback position over the last 3 years. It's more about the coaching part of it. I think they've mismanaged the offense, A, this entire season, and B, last year when Max Gillum came in. Like, they've been asking bad passers to throw a lot. And instead of giving the ball to Charles Williams, who's actually good. Like, they have guys that are, they have good players on the team. They have guys that are good at certain things on the team, but they don't play to their strength. They don't coach to their strengths nearly enough. They coach to what they're weak at or just average at way too much. And I think that's the ultimate problem here. This falls back to coaching and not really understanding what you have, not really understanding that Kenyon Oblad is at best an average passing quarterback in the Mountain West. Not understanding that Armani Rodgers is a below average passer in the Mountain West. Same for Max Gillum, and asking those guys to throw way too much. So I think that all comes back to the coach. Like, this should be a run team first. Like, this should be a team that to an extent can control the clock. For if you're in the fourth quarter, you're down two or three scores, okay, start throwing, speed it up. But even in the, if you're down 14 in the third quarter, run the ball. Like, there's no need to keep throwing it a ton when you're down in the third quarter.
I was going to say, run the ball more. Just do it faster.
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility, too. That's easier with Armani Rodgers because he runs up there and he can just snap it and run himself. Doesn't care if you got the play call in. But, yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. One other note on coaching. Some speculation by us yesterday that Sanchez might take the play calling based on his post-game comments, and now he was not thrilled with Garen Justice as the offensive coordinator in the play calling. Sanchez said yesterday that he is not going to take the play calling. That it will, Garen Justice is still going to call the plays. He actually yesterday sounded less upset with the play calling and more upset with the execution. He was particularly mad. It was three plays. One was a third down where they had a zone read call and the quarterback and running back messed up the mesh point, and so they didn't get a first down. The other one was a third down where they had a run play called and it was a high snap, so they couldn't actually hand the ball off very well to Charles Williams. Didn't get the first down. And the third one, Chad Maguire. I don't know where in the game it was, but Chad Maguire had a carry, and Sanchez said they had it perfectly executed, perfectly blocked. The tight end missed a block on a defensive end, and it ended up as like a 2 yard gain instead of a 20 yard gain. So he went back, and to him, it was like, we just had three or four plays where the execution was off. And if we get those plays, it's, you know, 14-7 at halftime, was his logic there. So he wasn't nearly as upset with the play calling yesterday as he was right after the game. Now, you were in the stands for the game on Saturday, right?
Uh-huh.
How many paper bags did you see?
Three.
Three paper bags?
Yes.
Lots of paper bags out for you. Did these people wear them the entire game?
They wore them the entire game that I was, like, looking at the crowd.
So, like, it wasn't just they put them on, had somebody take a picture, and then took it off, and they were fine.
No, like, there was a gentleman to my right wearing a paper bag, and the reason he burns in my mind is he was also wearing a Schmedium t-shirt when he was an XL.
So I tweeted one out that a friend sent me from the game. Not only was it a paper bag, but it had bullet points to pretty much explain why the paper bag was on. And now we need to figure out if these are good points. The number one bullet point on this paper bag was embarrassed alum. You're an alum. Are you embarrassed?
By our football team?
Yeah, you're at the football game, so yes.
Not really.
Yeah, and so
they've never been good.
Right, so I think it's, if you're embarrassed about the football team.
I mean, every once in a while they go to a bowl game, but we're a basketball school.
If you're embarrassed about the football team.
I'm embarrassed about the basketball team.
I don't think it's about this year. I think it's more of about the cumulative effect of UNLV never being good. That
you would think
said,
it would be cyclical, and they would, like.
It is cyclical. Two wins, four wins.
Yeah, you think they would.
No, that's the cycle. It's a good cycle. So being bad is the norm. So I think embarrassment, it's there. Like, you probably, UNLV has always been bad at football. You probably should be embarrassed, but it's not necessarily about this season specifically. Number two bullet point, hire a real college coach, which is more of a suggestion than an actual point and is really a follow-up to a later bullet point that we'll get to. Number three on the paper bag, the AD should be ashamed.
I don't know if she should be ashamed, but there's definitely a, when she came in, she sort of put an emphasis on football, and it doesn't feel like we've done a whole lot.
I don't know if shame is the right word.
Tony Sanchez was not Desiree Reed-Francois' hire.
Correct.
As far as what Mark Anderson told us, she wanted to fire Tony Sanchez at the end of last season, but was not able to. So this is not by any means her coach. This is not by any means like her responsibility. That being said, disappointment or disgust might be the right word, just because of how bad the season has been so far. Like,
it'd be one thing if they were competitive, but
if they were losing these games by 7 points, absolutely. But they've lost. They've been outscored by 103 points over the last four games.
Like, I'd be happy with 14, and it's like nothing.
Number four on the bullet point of the paper bag: we deserve better. Do you know we fans deserve better?
Considering I was honestly shocked at the amount of UNLV fans at a game against number 16 Boise, I mean, I would still say I believe the Boise fans outnumbered the UNLV fans, but...
But it was like 12,000 to 10,000.
Yeah, I legitimately was surprised how many people showed up.
So UNLV's been bad for a very, very long time, and I do feel bad for UNLV fans, because you don't get to experience college football. Like, the atmosphere-wise, college football is the best sport. Like, when you have a massive game for your team on a Saturday, it's a ton of fun to be a fan. When you have a massive home game, that's one of the greatest things in sports, is the college football atmosphere. And UNLV fans do not get that. They don't get that ever. Like, the best atmospheres are, oh, Hawaii brought a lot of fans that one time. Like,
yeah.
That's it, and that's not great. But the idea of deserve, like, let's not pretend UNLV has, like, awesome football fans.
Oh, no. Legitimately, in the fan section, there were people sitting backwards talking.
It's just fair.
It's fair. But I mean, yeah. Like, I mean, that was better than watching what was on the field, but I'm sitting there going, why did you come?
Now, the people that do
there's
go to
PTs
UNLV games
down the road.
The people that listen to this show, like, if you guys are the ones that I know are like, you guys are diehard UNLV fans because you're listening to the show to hear about UNLV football. I don't know what you're doing, why you're doing that, but you're doing it. So, like, there are UNLV fans that do deserve more, but it's like 5,000 of you. It's not a large portion. Number five, bullet point of the paperback: the only NCAA team with a high school coach, and it shows. That's a fair point.
What's our current ranking out of... Is it 130?
121 out of 130 in S&P Plus at the moment. Granted, Tony Sanchez has kept UNLV at the same level as the previous coaches for the most part. So it's probably not because he's a high school coach. They look like a high school team. It's more about UNLV. But
UNLV is a high school team, and we have a high school coach.
Number six, way to make the alumni proud. What would make UNLV alumni proud?
Can we finish third in the Mountain West?
Oh, see, I was thinking more on the theme of the paper bag, is they want Tony Sanchez fired. But just firing him isn't going to make you proud. They'd have to make a good hire, and I don't know what that good hire is.
Well, a friend of mine has a great theory about a certain Gruden brother.
Jay Gruden.
Yeah, who's now available.
Coaching UNLV football. So do you fire Tony Sanchez now and hire Jay Gruden?
I think you call Jay Gruden and go, don't worry, there's no way he's getting bowl eligible. We will offer you whatever Fertitta-based parking lot you need.
Wouldn't Jay Gruden make more money as an assistant under his brother than as the UNLV head coach?
I mean, but once you... I mean, maybe... I'm hoping that, like his brother, he likes power.
Do you have power if you're the UNLV football coach?
Apparently.
Totally correct. Brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Go to BeConnectedSports.com to download the mobile sports app for quick and easy betting from your phone or tablet. You can bet before the game or while you watch with in-game wagering. It is the Be Connected Sports app from Boyd Gaming.
Check out the podcast on LVSportsNetwork.com.
Hey, it's Tyler Bischoff. The best spot to place your bets is the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook. But if you're looking for even more convenience, download the Be Connected Sports app from BeConnectedSports.com. The Be Connected Sports app makes it easy to place bets from your phone or tablet and allows you to bet during the game. So download the Be Connected Sports app and you can be just a few clicks away from betting on the biggest games whenever you want. Boyd Gaming has you covered at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook or at BeConnectedSports.com.
Bischoff's Briefs.
underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
The Raiders traded for Zay Jones.
Wide receiver from the Buffalo Bills. The Raiders sent a 2021 fifth round pick. So two drafts away, fifth round pick. Jones has just seven catches this season, but he had 56 last year for 652 yards and seven touchdowns. So Zay Jones, if the Raiders are fully healthy, is the second, third best wide receiver. He's behind Tyrell Williams, somewhere with J.J. Nelson.
He's so fast.
Something like that. They're all just fast. I am sort of curious what the trade means as far as the Raiders' thoughts on this season. They need bodies at wide receiver. Trevor Davis was their number one wide receiver option last week.
They're fine.
Because Tyrell Williams and J.J. Nelson did not play. They should trade for somebody. They did not trade for Stephon Diggs. That would have required a high
Juju
pick.
Juju Smith-Schuster is not playing well.
If they had traded for Stephon Diggs, it would have been going all in now, which probably would have been dumb. But giving up a fifth-round pick is not usually a move that true rebuilding teams make. So I don't know what... It's somewhere in the middle. It's somewhere in the middle of we're rebuilding and we're going for it. They're somewhere in between. They're like, we don't really know, we need a wide receiver in here, so we're going to go get Zay Jones, and we're going to give him a 2021 fifth-round pick, which is 2 years away. So I don't know what it means that much, but I like the deal in terms of they didn't really give up a lot. Two drafts away and a fifth-round pick isn't very much. Not that Zay Jones is that great of a wide receiver, but he might end up being your second-best wide receiver for the rest of the year. Like, it's probably going to be Tyrell Williams and Zay Jones.
Where was he drafted? Second round?
Zay Jones? I don't actually know. Was he a second round pick?
Second round pick number 37. Oh, he played... Okay, all right, well...
He played what?
No, I misread the internet, and his high school was Stephen F. Austin. And so I was like, oh, okay. He went to a small school. And then I was like, that's a high school, Jared. But still, second round pick for a fifth...
Stephen F. Austin's a college. What are you talking about?
No, he went to the high school, Stephen F. Austin.
There's also...
That's why I was confused. School? Yeah, he went to East Carolina for college, but I...
How many people go from Stephen F. Austin to high school? Are they in the same city? Are they, like, right next door to each other?
I don't know. Is it a feeder campus? I don't know. Is that what you want me to do during the next break, is research a high school in Texas?
Yes, please.
All right.
Just make that the traffic. go ahead.
No, wait, no. Go, you go.
You got to read the next brief.
UNLV will play Pepperdine in a secret scrimmage.
Before we get to basketball, Fernando Agundez just tweeted at me. We listen to the show every day to hear the firing of Sanchez. Fair. So, Jeff Goodman of Stadium reporting on secret scrimmages. UNLV will play Pepperdine.
What national news person who doesn't cover UNLV ever is going to break the Sanchez has been fired news? Because that seems to be how UNLV announces all of its...
Brett McMurphy from Stadium.
Okay. Because, yeah. It's like, hasn't tweeted about UNLV in 4 years. Suddenly has the coaching news.
Yes. Brett McMurphy, Stadium.com. College basketball and their secret scrimmages. You are allowed in college basketball to have two exhibition/scrimmages against other teams. Most teams play one exhibition where fans come. It's against a lower level team. UNLV will do that. And then they play a secret scrimmage against a better opponent. That secret scrimmage is not allowed to have fans or media at it, and the coaches and players are not allowed to publicly discuss it. It is very dumb. It is very stupid that the NCAA does this. Just have your secret scrimmage, let the coaches talk about it, or just everything's next. I don't know. It's just very stupid. It's like, here's a secret scrimmage. Nobody knows about it.
No fans, but put it on TV.
Yeah, that'd be hilarious. It's actually what they should do. It's like watching baseball, right?
Well, I was going to say it'd be like that Orioles game after the riots.
So UNLV plays Pepperdine on October 19th. The interesting part of Pepperdine is they're not exactly good. They were 15-19 last season. They were 150 in KenPom, so it's not like they're atrocious, but... it's not usually when we see UNLV play a secret scrimmage, they're playing a Pac-12 team. And usually it's like, oh, we want to go play a team that's probably going to be slightly better than us and sort of grade ourselves from there. So it's a weird one because, I don't know, it's sort of like, yeah, you should expect to be better than Pepperdine this year, so you should expect to win that exhibition or that scrimmage, I should say.
According to U.S. News, Pepperdine is in the top 50 of national universities. So they're going to hopefully beat up some smart kids.
Top 50 of what?
Of all universities in the United States.
In what?
In everything. Like, it's
in everything.
It's what's the word I'm looking for?
I don't know.
It's not an amalgamation. Never mind. Shut up. Bill Foley is having continuous discussion with MLS about an expansion franchise.
He joined the Sinbin podcast.
Is that how you wanted that phrased?
What?
Is having continuous discussion with MLS. All right.
Discussions with MLS, yeah.
There's no S there.
Yeah, there should be.
Okay.
Yeah, he was on the Sinbin.
It just sounds like
Vegas
constantly
podcast.
Has a phone call going that he's like, set it down for a while, but don't hang up.
Bill Foley said, I know they want to be in Vegas, but they have a lot of other alternatives. Here's the important part, though, for Foley FC to work. Foley said the key element is working out a transaction with Allegiant Stadium and the Raiders, and can we make it make sense for us? So there are a few things from that we know, or probably know. But the top two transactions they have to figure out are revenue and scheduling. As of now, the Raiders essentially can make all the revenue off of whatever events go into that stadium. The Raiders have to come to whatever agreements with third parties for third-party events in that stadium. Foley and Major League Soccer won't like any sort of setup where Mark Davis is getting all of the revenue. So you have to come to some sort of revenue share or hope that Mark Davis gives it all up. So that's a big question. How much of the revenue is Mark Davis willing to give up to have a Major League Soccer team in that stadium? If he wants a high percentage, he probably doesn't. You probably don't get an MLS team in that stadium. If he's willing to take a very low percentage or none at all, it's possible. The other part is scheduling. The Raiders play Sundays. UNLV football plays on Saturdays. Those are your top two tenants other than Beyonce in that stadium. Ooh. It is possible the Major League Soccer could make it work as a third tenant trying to play games in the fall, but the problem is Major League Soccer, I mean, their playoffs are starting soon. Like, they play through October. If you make it to the MLS Cup, you're in November. You play through the first 2 months of football season if you're a Major League Soccer team, and Major League Soccer plays on Saturdays and Sundays throughout the fall or throughout the first 2 months of football season. So how does that work? Major League Soccer is probably not going to want to be trying to schedule a Las Vegas team on Thursdays during the fall. They want to play on Saturdays and Sundays. Can they make that work? I think ultimately Major League Soccer is going to like the downtown plan better if that ever actually happens between the city of Las Vegas and the Seth Klarman group. You're going to have a soccer-specific stadium. You're going to have the Major League Soccer team owning 100% of the revenue and controlling 100% of the scheduling. Like, that's a better setup for Major League Soccer. But there is a stadium already built. You just have to come to an agreement with Mark Davis to actually have it work at Raider Stadium.
The Golden Knights' third jersey might not be gold.
We have assumed, thanks to Jesse Granger from The Athletic and Ken Bolke from Sinbin, that the alternate jersey for the Golden Knights will be gold. Bill Foley has said it has to stand out. It will pop. Well, Sinbin.Vegas tweeted
it's
a picture
red.
Of some hats that the NHL sells that are based on third jerseys. And the Golden Knights hat has like a light gray brim, and part of the top of it is gold. If you look at all of the other teams' hats, whatever color the brim of the hat is matches the primary color of the jersey. So the Golden Knights hat's brim is light gray, which would indicate that their third jersey will be light gray and not gold, which might be the dumbest possible way to design an alternate jersey when your current jersey is dark gray.
Yeah. Am I the only one hoping for red?
So,
like, if you're not going gold, give me red at the very least.
The order of colors your alternate jersey should be if you're the Golden Knights. Number one, it should be gold because you're the Golden Bleeping Knights. Number two is red. You've had red as sort of this tertiary color in your jerseys. It would be a great third jersey, and it would, quote-unquote, pop. The fourth option would be black, just because people love black jerseys. and you don't have a black one, but that would be third in order. Like, 75th on the list is light gray.
Yeah.
Like, you already have a dark gray jersey.
It's right below getting hit by a bus.
Why would you want light gray? Bungalow gold is ahead of light gray. So I hope they're the exception to the rule with these hats and the third jerseys, because it just it doesn't make any sense.
I hope these hats were, like, just designed by the league, and so the team
they
was...
were.
No, I'm saying, like, the team's just like, what? No. They just put some colors together.
But all the other ones, also designed by the league, the brim matches the jersey color.
What if instead of light gray, though, it's silver?
Same difference. Same color.
Like a shiny silver.
Yeah. How shiny? Are we getting ridiculously shiny?
Oh, yeah.
Like they look like aluminum foil?
Yeah, like
that
mirror.
That would be
mirror
fun.
Sheen.
Yeah, that would be fun. But that's not going to happen.
I hope it is.
That's not what the hat looks like either.
I hope the lights, they literally blind both themselves and the other team.
Technically Correct is brought to you by Michael E. Menden Diamond Jewelers in the Fashion Show Mall. Are you looking for the best way to show off your love of the Golden Knights? Michael E. Menden Diamond Jewelers has the largest selection of officially licensed Golden Knights jewelry with watches, cufflinks, bracelets, and more. Get yours today. Michael E. Menden Diamond Jewelers is where Las Vegas buys diamonds and engagement rings and is your home for officially licensed Raiders and Golden Knights jewelry.
So I know your girlfriend's a big, like, VGK fan, so is that the plan? Are you getting her, like...
propose with a Golden Knights ring? I think it's a terrible idea.
It's a terrible idea, but I mean... So you've eliminated that from the list.
Although, I could buy, like, a Golden Knights cufflink and propose with that. That'd be way cheaper.
Good God. Yeah, every girl is thinking about... Well, he proposed with a cufflink. It was very cost-efficient.
Yeah, what do you mean? Logic.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
There's no I in team. Yeah, there's no you either. So I guess if I'm not on the team and you're not on the team, nobody's on the goddamn team. The team sucks.
It's Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff.
You ready to give Tom Cable credit?
Someone deserves it.
So the long-term plan for the Raiders offensive line, they went and got Colt Miller in the first round of John Gruden's first draft. It was a reach with that pick. Colt Miller was not very good last year.
Was it a reach or was it, you know, they went, we don't know. They picked our guy. Tom, pick a person. And he just sort of went, that guy.
Whatever they did was better than that contribution.
All right, fair enough.
They then made Trent Brown the highest paid offensive tackle in NFL history. Made him play right tackle. And then they played Khalil Mack. And Khalil Mack had 3 tackles, no sacks, no forced fumble. He did recover a fumble when Derek Carr threw it back to the goal line. But Mack was shut down as much as Khalil Mack can be shut down. And now I think Colt Miller and Trent Brown pretty much don't have to do anything ever again to be considered a success for John Gruden, because John Gruden traded away one of the biggest havoc inducers in the NFL in Khalil Mack. Khalil Mack had basically as many sacks and forced fumbles as the Raiders in the last 20 games. And then when he finally had to play against him, Khalil Mack was next to useless for the Bears. He didn't do anything to create havoc in that game. It would have been an absolute disaster for, like, imagine the Bears win that game by 14, and Khalil Mack had 3 sacks, forced a fumble, and had a pick. John Gruden would, like, it would have been a disaster for John Gruden. But instead, Khalil Mack did almost nothing, and it looks great for John Gruden. Colton Miller, Trent Brown did a lot. So Gruden wins. Gruden is the winner of the trade. What's actually funny, though, Brandon Thorne, who writes for The Athletic, tweeted out a video of Khalil Mack's pass rushes against the Raiders. He counted just 3 times that any offensive tackle had to block Mack one-on-one in that game. They were double-teaming him with tight ends and fullbacks or running backs all game. Hell, there was one snap in his video where they just had 2 tight ends on the same side of the field. They called a pass play. The 2 tight ends just blocked Mack. Didn't even go out as a pass. They were just like, our job is to block Khalil Mack. So it was definitely not simply the offensive tackles doing a great job on Mack. It was the game plan. They centered their offensive game plan around, how do we block that guy? Okay, we're going to call a pass play, and instead of sending 5 guys out in the pass, we're going to have 2 of them specifically block Khalil Mack so that Colt Miller doesn't even have to worry about him. It's just the tight ends got him. So it was a game plan built to stop Khalil Mack, and it worked.
All right. here's my stupid question. They lost. They had a player who didn't start, right? And they lost someone on the they lost one of their linebackers early, right? The Bears.
I don't know.
But they lost Hayes. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Yes, they lost. Was it a linebacker? I can't remember. Somebody went in the tent and then was done for the game.
And they sold out to stop one of the most destructive forces in all of football. They won by, like, what, 3 points?
They won. They were the underdogs. What do you mean?
I know, but
they weren't playing the freaking Broncos.
Oh, fair enough.
The Bears might, I mean, we'll see if
Chase
they catch
Daniel.
The Packers. Yeah, but that's the other side of the ball. Like, they did good against the Bears defense. Like, Richie Incognito gets called for a 15-yard personal foul that takes them out. Well, they still could have tried the field goal, but took them away from a 39-yard field goal.
And that guy I don't trust.
Trevor Davis fumbled on the 1-yard line. Like, there were 10 more points in that game that the Raiders probably should have scored with no wide receiver. Like, they had
Unfortunately, they're still the Raiders.
Right.
They're still incompetent.
It was only 24, but, like, no, the Bears are a really good defense. And that was one of the, I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was one of the best yardage and point totals the Bears have given up in, like, 4 years. Like, it was one of the best offensive performances by not Tom Brady in, like, 4 years. Now, I have a tweet from Chris Reed who sent out, Khalil Mack, 3 tackles. Josh Jacobs, 26 carries, 123 yards, 4.7 yards per carry, 2 touchdowns, and 3 receptions for another 20 yards. Raiders still have another first-round pick and cap space and look like they came out of that trade better than they have gotten credit for. First off, very much appreciate that tweet because that is something I would send based on a 1-game sample size, like the fact that Eric Halla has 3 goals so far this year, and the Golden Knights traded him away for Nick Waugh and a 5th-round pick. Conditional 5th-round pick. Terrible trade. But,
hey, they might get that 5th-round pick.
They might. On Khalil Mack and the Raiders, first off, the idea that having more cap space is a good thing is only a positive if you use said cap space. The Raiders right now have $25 million in cap space. Having $25 million in cap space isn't a positive unless you use it, and they're not using it. So that's not really an added benefit of the trade, especially because Khalil Mack's cap hit this year is $11.9 million. They could have Khalil Mack on his current contract and be under the salary cap right now. Now, granted, it goes up to $26 million next season, but based on their cap space now, they could still have Khalil Mack on the team. They could still afford him against the cap. Now on Josh Jacobs. What people don't understand with running backs is the actual value of running backs. It's not about whether or not Josh Jacobs is good. He is good. I think Josh Jacobs is excellent. But how much better is Josh Jacobs than the average running back? That's the question when you take a running back in the first round. That's why people don't take running backs in the first rounds, because the benefit of Josh Jacobs compared to the average running back is not that large. He was the number one running back in the draft. Like, everybody's draft board had him as the number one running back. There's no doubting that he was good. It's just taking him in the first round is too high, and then comparing him to Khalil Mack is also somewhat ridiculous, but it'll happen because that was the trade. That was Josh Jacobs' best game yet. 26 carries, 123 yards. He was very good. As a comparison, last season, Doug Martin only had 2 games with 20 or more carries. Raiders were losing a lot. They didn't really get to run the ball very much. In those 2 games, Doug Martin, 21 carries for 107 yards against the Broncos and 21 carries for 100 yards against the Chiefs. Both of those games, his yards per carry was better than Josh Jacobs just put up against the Bears. So if you gave Doug Martin 26 carries in that game against the Bears, he's giving you more than 100 yards. He's probably getting pretty close to Josh Jacobs' 123 yards. Even take Isaiah Crowell, the running back the Raiders signed in the offseason, but then, what was it, an Achilles injury? And he's done for the entire year. In Isaiah Crowell's career, he has 5 games with 18 carries or more. He's never had more than 21 in a game. His rushing totals in those 5 games are 98 yards, 121 yards, 133 yards, 145 yards, and 152 yards. If you had a healthy Isaiah Crowell and you gave him 26 carries, he's probably giving you the same production that Josh Jacobs did. Josh Jacobs is good. There's no denying he's good, but the value of Josh Jacobs to an average NFL running back, the value of Josh Jacobs over Doug Martin or Isaiah Crowell or any other average running back in the NFL is not significant enough to say, oh yeah, that's worth getting rid of Khalil Mack.
I thought the current show theory was the reason they drafted him, Jacobs, was because Crowell's Achilles exploded.
No, they didn't. Crowell's, I have to look at the timeline. I thought Crowell's Achilles got hurt after the draft.
No, I'm fairly certain it got hurt before the draft. They then immediately drafted a running back.
I think they were always going after Josh Jacobs, but I might be wrong.
Oh, so they're just dumb. Got it. Okay.
I mean, yeah, they just really wanted. They watched one college football game. It was the national championship.
I thought they only watched the first half.
Maybe only the first half. What? Yeah, had to go to bed. But yeah, that was it.
Is that better or worse than Gettleman watching only the? Was it the Senior Bowl that he watched?
Now, I don't know when Crowell actually got injured, but his injury was reported on May 3rd, which is about 2 weeks after the draft, or a week after the draft. So his injury, as far as we know, happened after they drafted Josh Jacobs. So the plan was to go Jacobs, Isaiah Crowell, and one of DeAndre Washington and Jalen Richard. Or Doug Martin. But the point on running backs is not that Josh Jacobs isn't good. The point on running backs is that if you give pretty much any running back in the NFL 26 carries, they're going to give you 100-something yards.
Except for Trent Richardson.
That's a good point. He's not in the NFL anymore, though. So,
well, there's a reason for that.
If you give pretty much anybody in the NFL 26 carries, they're going to get you 100-plus yards. They're going to get close to the 123 that Jacobs had. It's not that Jacobs isn't good. It's not that Jacobs didn't have great runs in that game. He had a handful of awesome runs in that game. But when you get 26 carries, pretty much every NFL running back is going to have their handful of awesome runs in that game. So again, the criticism of the Jacobs pick is about the value of drafting a running back in the first round. A, you probably could have drafted him with your first pick in the second round where you got Trayvon Mullen. I don't think that guy's even played this year. You probably could have gotten him in the second round at that pick, or you could have taken pretty much any other rookie running back in the draft in the third, fourth, fifth round, given him 26 carries, and he probably goes off for 120-something yards in that game. Jacobs is good, but he's not anything special. He's not. There's like three running backs that are like Christian McCaffrey is ridiculous. I think Pro Football Focus said he's forced 25 missed tackles in the last 2 weeks. That's ridiculous. It's insane. Like he's upset. He's insane. Like Ezekiel Elliott's probably one of them, and like maybe Alvin Kamara, maybe. But that's it. Like, outside of those, and maybe Saquon Barkley, but outside of those, it's like every other running back is sort of in the same tier of goodness. Some are better, but it's not by much. So don't waste draft capital or salary cap space when it's not going to give you that much of a benefit.
One of my favorite stats I've ever seen was Jay Ajayi when he was still with the Dolphins.
He's not still with the Dolphins?
His point of contact was negative 4 yards. So he would literally, and he was averaging like 3.2 yards, but his average point of contact was he'd get the ball and then have to drag a defender an additional 7 yards.
So he would have like 74 yards rushing, 85 after contact.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
My favorite stat of the year so far is Leonard Fournette. He had 66 rushing yards against, I think it was the Titans. He had 66 rushing yards against the Titans. His longest run of the day was for 69 yards. he was like 12 carries for negative 5 yards, and then he had a 69-yard rush.
All right. Just quick story. The first 1,000-yard rusher in the history of the Atlanta Falcons, I don't remember his name, but he got 1,000 yards. It was the final game of the season. It was the fourth quarter. They stopped the game. They give him the ball, and they're like, he's the first 1,000-yard rusher in the history of the Atlanta Falcons. The next play, they call a run. He loses 5 yards.
Did they stop play to, like, take away
the No. They're just like, oh, so crap. He finished the season with 995 yards.
No, crap. We messed this up. Cody Eakin might be back soon for the Golden Knights. What should Gerard Gallant do with his two Cody centers?
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at Bischoff_Tyler.
They twist on it.
They did.
Twist, and it's
it turned it around.
We should have thought of that.
We were so...
But it's still a stupid
It's such a
cover.
Fine line between stupid and clever.
Yeah, it's just a little turnabout.
Tyler Bischoff is technically correct.
Gerard Gallant said yesterday that Cody Eakin will play when healthy. His quote, thanks to Sin Bin, was, whenever he's ready to play, he'll play. So that creates a fun game of lineup reshuffling with Cody Eakin coming back. He's probably not playing tonight, by the way. But at some point, they play on Thursday and then on Saturday. So at some point this week, good chance you see Cody Eakin back, if not the week after that. His injury caused Gerard Gallant to drop Paul Stastny down to the third line in what Eakin's normal spot would be, and put Cody Glass in the center spot on the second line with Stone and Pacioretty. Even before Eakin got hurt, Glass did get a look as a winger in the preseason, and Gallant said that was to give Cody Glass a fair shot at making the roster. So I'm curious if Gallant is ready to try Glass on a wing and go back to sort of his preferred top six before the Cody Eakin injury, that would bump Stastny back up to line two. Or if he's liked what he's seen enough from Cody Glass, and there'll be, you know, one or two more games before that too, if he's liked what he's seen enough from Cody Glass to leave him as the second line center and put Eakin as either your fourth line center or as a wing on the third line somewhere else other than his normal third line center spot. What I'm curious about over the next two games when they play somebody not named the Sharks. Yesterday, we did talk about the analytics behind Cody Glass and them not being too great. He's got a Corsi under 50%. He's got an expected goals for under 50%. And Stone has been much better in the few minutes he's played without Glass. But to add to those stats, Pacioretty, Glass, and Stone, they've been outshot, but they are producing high danger chances. If you look at the Golden Knights' lines this year, William Karlsson's line, creating 25 high danger chances per 60 minutes. The Glass line is creating 16. The Stastny line with Peary and Zikov is at 8. 8 high danger chances per 60. The fourth line is at 11 high danger chances per 60. So that 16 high danger chances per 60 minutes is actually good from the Glass, Stone, Pacioretty line. Last year, with Stastny and Pacioretty and Stone, they were only at 15 high danger chances per 60 minutes. The big difference, though, with Stastny, they only allowed 10 high danger chances to the opponent. With Glass right now, they're allowing 16. So they're basically a net zero because they're getting 16 and allowing 16, whereas last year they were getting 15 and allowing 10. It's a small sample size, but I would be willing to bet that kind of holds true, that with Glass on that line, they'll still produce offensive chances, but they'll give up a few more the other way, whereas with Stastny there, you're producing the offensive chances and also limiting a good chunk of the opponent's chances. Again, small sample size, but with Cody Eakin coming back, you're working off of a very small sample size to decide if you want to leave Cody Glass with that second line. I would think, I don't know, I do not think Cody Glass second line center is the best option for this team to win the Stanley Cup. I think you're better off with Paul Stastny on that line and going with a powerhouse top six, and then Eakin and Glass figure out the third line, whether one of them's the center or one of them's the winger. So I don't think that's going to be a great line if Glass is there. Like, you'll have a good second line, but it won't be one of the best second lines in hockey like you would have had. So I'm curious what Gallant does. Does he go back to the powerhouse top six, or does he want to redistribute his talent a little bit more because they like Cody Glass in that second line spot? I will say this. Good thing for the Golden Knights is their center depth is extremely strong at the moment. Just on the NHL roster, you've got William Karlsson, Paul Stastny, Cody Eakin, Cody Glass, Tomáš Nosek, and Nicholas Waugh. Like, that's six options that are probably pretty solid. Like, you haven't even used Nick Waugh yet this year, and Eakin's been hurt. So that's six options that are probably really good. You've just got to decide which one do you move to wing, which one do you make a healthy scratch. But we'll see. Cody Glass, another chance to prove it with Mark Stone.
You suck, Tyler.